You're listening to the Groundswell Sermon Podcast, a brand new church in the Halton region, Ontario, Canada.
Is this on and working okay? All right, great. So yes, now you know my name is Mary Martin, and I am certainly honored to be here this morning at the invitation of Brian and Peggy. I'm sorry to miss seeing Peggy this morning. I have fond memories of working along in various church initiatives with both of you, and thank you for welcoming both me and my husband, Dean. I do want to say that I have been impacted most recently in kind of a fresh way about the fact that Jesus really honored women. So I love this. I love that there is a day set aside for all women, in my view, and that Jesus really changed the way people thought and behaved for women. So happy Mother's Day once again. In honor of Mother's Day, I thought we would look at the lives of two women whose story is in the book of Ruth. It's one of my favorite stories. I think it's so artfully told, and there's an anonymous author, which lends it a little mystery. And the action in the book is made up of not divine miracles or big armies doing powerful things, but it's made up of the story of three people and how they just made good choices and surrendered to each other and to God, and then they were hugely blessed. And that's something that we have the opportunity to do too. We can make those good choices like they did, and we will experience God's blessing as well. We'll be on the hunt for some timeless truths in this story, and though they may not be brand new discoveries, I hope that as we bring them back to the top of our minds, we will have some fresh consideration for them and maybe some fresh application in our lives. So those truths are the following. Number one, God promises his presence to those who trust him, manifested through, among other things, protection and provision. Number two, obedience prepares the way to experience God's blessing. And as I say that, I want to qualify saying, I'm not saying that if we obey, we will receive exactly as we think blessing should look, right? It's not transactional, but we have to start with the obedience, and that prepares the way for God's blessing. Number three, God's people can display righteous character despite circumstances and a surrounding culture. And we're certainly living in those times. And then the overarching truth that we will see in here is that God's loving kindness, has said, is a completely undeserved kindness and generosity, and he goes beyond our wildest imagination with that. So let's get into our story and see where these principles are revealed. A little background just to remind us that this story takes place in the time of the judges, when the judges ruled. There were a few good times in there, but there's a lot of dark stories in that book. It's a hard read at times. And it finishes with this. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. And I think it was Dr. Phil who used to say, and how is that working for you? Was not. And it, in fact, wasn't true. Israel did have a king. God was their king. But they wanted a human king. They wanted to be like everyone else. And there's a whole sermon there, but we won't go there. So the story of Ruth and Naomi stands as a contrast in this time period. And although I would just love to read the whole book to you, I won't. But we'll start in Ruth chapter 1 and verse 1. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. There's just a few things I want to pull out of that before we move on. In the first couple of verses, names in the ancient Near East, of course, were really significant. They were sometimes descriptive of a person's appearance, or it could be that they reflected some character of the person. Bethlehem as a town, that name meant house of food or house of bread. And we have this contrast. There's a famine in the house of bread. And it says that a man together with his wife and two sons, which to me implies that Naomi was in on this plan. It doesn't say Elimelech took his wife and his sons. It says together they went to for a while. Sorry, I'm fighting with my collar here. There we go. For a while. So they intended it to be temporary. And then it finishes that little section with, and they went to Moab and lived there. So sometimes we make what we think is a temporary compromise, perhaps, and it can turn out to be a longer than we plan. The man's name was Elimelech. That meant my God is king. His wife's name was Naomi. Her name meant pleasant. And so they're heading off as a family. Now, their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, and those names mean weakling and frail. So it didn't bode well for the future of the family when the two sons are already in that spot. But that's how it starts out. And then verse 3. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth, after they had lived there about 10 years. So they've dug in a bit. Both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her sons and her husband. So there was a famine of food to begin with, a famine of faith, perhaps, that God would provide in that situation, now to a famine of life. There's no life. She's lost her husband, she's lost her two sons, and her two daughters-in-law are not producing children. So this gets Naomi's attention, I think, in a fresh way. So from this vantage point, we might conclude that Naomi has hit rock bottom. She's at the end of her own ideas, perhaps her own creativity, her own energy on how to make a life here. And I know for myself, sometimes I approach a problem and I think, okay, here's what I'll do, and I use what I think are my best wits and energy and effort, and then can come to the end of myself and I haven't solved the problem, and that's when I go, oh right, yes, God would like me to consult him about this. So we see that Naomi has come to the end of herself, and she changes course. She chooses to look where God is blessing, and she hears that there is food again in Bethlehem, and she decides to go back there. What do you think her emotional state might have been at that point, besides obviously just discouraged? Because I'm thinking, it feels like the sense of that story is that it was all her, at least agreement to go to Moab. Maybe it was even her idea. We don't know. And it's all fallen apart. So she's probably feeling maybe embarrassment, maybe deeper than that, maybe some shame about having to go back. Certainly she's going back without her family, and that would be emotionally really difficult time. On her way back to Bethlehem, we have the scenes describing how Orpah and Ruth cling to her. They want to go with her. They're weeping. They say, take us with you. And this shows us a bit of Naomi's character in that, right? Because these are daughters-in-law, and they're willing to leave what's familiar to them to go with her. So I think we can surmise here that Naomi had good character. She was a good woman, and she inspired that love and loyalty from these daughters-in-law. And then if you haven't read it for a while, you can read through it later, but Orpah decides to turn around and go back to her home, and Ruth has that beautiful promise of being with Naomi to the end of life, and so they carry on together. When Naomi arrives in Bethlehem, it's a town of about, it said in that time, probably between around 300 and 900 people, so not huge. People knew her. On her way back to Bethlehem, when Naomi arrives in Bethlehem, she believes she is empty. That's what she says. It's as if she doesn't even acknowledge Ruth is with her. So in verse 19, we read, "So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, 'Can this be Naomi?'" So we know she must have looked quite a bit different than when she left, at least the 10 years before. Maybe gray, maybe thin, drawn, sad. "Don't call me Naomi," she told them. "Call me Mara," which meant bitter, "because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi or pleasant? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought me has brought misfortune upon me." So I don't know if that's a familiar reaction at times when things don't play out the way we expect. Sometimes we feel punished by God, don't we? And she's feeling punished by the Lord. Now, what I find interesting is Naomi declares she's empty. She's without. And in fact, she has three significant benefits right at that time. So in verse 22, we read, "So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem at the time of the barley harvest." And those three things are huge benefits to her. But Ruth, who she almost is just discounting as any benefit, is going to be her means of redemption of her past, because she's lost everyone, right? And Ruth is going to be the means to redeem her past. She's back in her homeland, where her husband had land claims, and through Elimelech, through Boaz, her future will be redeemed, and she's arriving at the barley harvest, so her present precarious situation is also redeemed. It would have been very dangerous and a vulnerable place for two women on their own in that time frame. So, it's here in the story that we begin to see things turn around for Naomi. We see her recognizing God's presence in her circumstances, and she begins to see his love for her as he protects her and provides for her. So the second act of the drama begins in chapter 2, and Ruth, good character again, rising to the surface. She asked Naomi for permission. "Can I go glean in the fields?" And this is not a woman who's just there to take advantage or be taken care of. So Naomi gives her permission to do that. Ruth is living honorably in a culture where everyone was doing as they saw fit, right? Ruth is not grasping at opportunity, but she's surrendering to her mother-in-law out of love and respect. She's displaying an obedience that's going to prepare the way for great blessing. Remember, she had converted to Naomi's God. She had said, "Your God will be my God." And she is submitting to all of that and the ways of Naomi's world. I believe this got everyone's attention. It got God's attention. Certainly seemed to get Naomi's attention. And then it gets the attention of the third main player in our story. So chapter 2 and verse 3 reads like this. See the beginning of it. "So she went out," that's Ruth, "entered a field and began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out," she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. "As it turned out." And the very next verse, "Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem." This is great storytelling. So God's presence is notable often in the timing, right? We can have various events happening, and it's the timing that sometimes really gets our attention. We had an experience recently. It was actually 4 weeks ago tomorrow. We have two daughters and then two sons, and our older son is lost a bit vocationally, and so he had in his mind for several months that he was going to go to Ukraine and support the effort on the west side of the country, he assures me, and not on the front lines. And so he had his plan to be leaving on a particular day, and Dean said, can we drive you to the airport? He said, sure, that would be great. So we said our emotional goodbyes and then packed in the car and drove him to the airport and let him out. And we were kind of waving goodbye with, you know, hearts full, not knowing what was ahead. And I'm not kidding, I shut the door of the car and my phone dinged. And I looked at my phone and our youngest son said, baby is here. And they had had their first child a week early. Within seconds, I got those two emotions pulling us very far apart. And so at the end of the day, Dean and I were looking over the day and saying, I think that was God's compassion for us, because we were feeling sad and we were little, you know, wondering what was ahead for Josh, but you cannot help but celebrate a brand new life. And so it gave us that sort of balance by the end of the day. So that's in the timing. So we can always look for timing and what that might mean. Sometimes it's correction, sometimes it's blessing, sometimes it's guidance. It can be a number of things, but God is in the timing. When Boaz learns who Ruth is, he pours out his blessing on her. He protects her by instructing her to stay in his fields. He tells his men not to lay a hand on her. That was a dangerous place for a woman to be. He invites her to drink from his water jugs. He asks her to come and eat lunch and gives her more than she can possibly eat, so she has tons left over. And as she returns to the field, he instructs his men, leave some sheaves on the ground so it's easy for her to harvest a lot of grain. Now, Boaz really didn't have to do all of that, right? But he goes beyond what might have been expected in that culture. And it reminds me of God and his lavish love for us. See what great love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. That's so beyond what we deserve, right? And I think Boaz in this part is a, a picture there of God's loving kindness that he lavishes on us. With Boaz in the story, and Naomi lays out a strategy for Ruth to propose marriage to him. So some people might consider that was manipulative. I don't know, you can decide. But I do believe that Naomi was looking ahead a little bit. Ruth continued to glean through the harvest. But, you know, these two women weren't going to just live on that for the rest of their lives. And I think Naomi was, you know, caring for Ruth and saying, you need to have a husband, you need to have children. This will be a good future for you. So she gives Ruth very specific instructions, and according to the story, Ruth follows them. She's very obedient that way. She's very respectful that way. I do chuckle when I think of Boaz waking up, finding a woman lying there on the threshing floor. He must have gone, what is happening? But then we see Boaz's good character yet again as he protects her honor, and he goes through all the proper steps to conclude with him being the kinsman redeemer for Elimelech's family. So there's no criticism of how they handled all of that. And then can provide an heir to continue that family line for Elimelech, which had been lost with the death of the two sons. So I'm just going to skip to the end of the story. And chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Boom. Love that ending. That must have just, yeah. love reading that for the first time, and everyone goes, wow. So it's a great storytelling technique. So we see at the end then of this scenario that Naomi's life is completely redeemed. Her past is redeemed through Ruth. Prior to that, she was childless. Naomi was. Her present is redeemed through Boaz, who provides that instant security. And her future is redeemed through the birth of Obed and Jesse and David and ultimately the line that includes Jesus Christ. All of this comes about through people making choices to act righteously, obeying God's ways, and seeking his presence in their lives. And the result is the hesed, the loving kindness of God poured out on them all. There's a bit of a story it's similar in some ways. So there was a young couple named Kathy and Dave, and they were having a relationship, and she got pregnant, and they had some cultural differences a bit, they had some religious differences a bit that caused them to part ways. And Dave never knew his daughter that was born to Kathy. Her name was Kara. And Kathy and Kara came and lived with an extended family, and she was loved and all was, you know, okay. And Dave, several years later, never met his daughter. Several years later, he married a woman named Maggie. And they built a great big farmhouse. And they put 4 big bedrooms upstairs. And they imagined filling those rooms with children. They wanted a big family. And year after year after year, no children. No children. There stood the farmhouse, you know, just a testament to the broken dreams. And it was a lot of hurt. And through the years, then Dave went to another state to do some business. He would come back and forth a little bit, but he was often not there, and Maggie would go to work and come home to this empty house. And Kara grew up, married, and had 3 children. And although she had always wanted to meet her father, she put it off and put it off and put it off, and she didn't want to mess up his life. But she finally came to the point where she's, I really have to contact him. I want to meet him. So she contacted him in this second location where he spent quite a bit of time. And, you know, there was some resistance. There was back and forth and a delay, and months and months and months went by. And finally she thought, that's it. She got a big envelope. She put in the pictures of her children. She put in the pictures of she and her husband. She wrote the story briefly. She put her phone number, contact number, and she mailed it to the farmhouse. And addressed it to him, but mailed it to the farmhouse. And the other side of that scenario then is Maggie comes home from work one day, gets the mail, sees this big envelope, and there had been an agreement among them to open each other's mail that wasn't really an issue for her, so she rips open the envelope. Out falls a family. And do you know what she did? I know there must have been a riot of emotions and feelings at that moment. She did not know about Kara. She did not know about her all these years. But she picked up her phone and she texted Kara and she wrote, I opened the envelope and I already love you. That was a heart that was prepared, right? Obedience that was prepared for blessing. She had never turned against God. She just lived with her broken dreams and thought, I guess this is my life, right? No children, all these empty rooms. And so They all then connected. Dave came back up and they had some times together. Those bedrooms got cleaned out and got some beds put in them, and the grandchildren were up there, and they were having 3 years of time where that house felt at least a little bit full some of the time. And 8 years ago this month, David died. Just died very suddenly. And that was hard. It was really, really hard for Kara to think, I got 3 years with him. But in this part of this story too, I see is that Maggie could have been without, right? She already had no children of her own, and Dave would have passed away. She would have been alone. But because of her heart and the way she had kept her heart open to the Lord, even though they've grieved his loss, certainly a lot, they have each other. And Maggie now has a stepdaughter and son-in-law and these three grandchildren and a couple of the grandchildren who probably will have some great-grandchildren in Maggie's lifetime. So Kara is my niece. Kathy, my sister, is her birth mother. And then Maggie is this lovely addition to the family, and everyone gets along. Everyone makes it work. So that's great. Brian tells me that you sometimes break into small groups and have a little time of discussion. So I was thinking that if this works for you, the story of Naomi and Ruth and Boaz, it stands in contrast to the times in which they lived. They didn't choose to just do as they saw fit, but instead they surrendered to one another in obedience to God. And I'm thinking, what are some of the lifestyle choices that we can make as followers of Jesus that would stand in contrast to the culture around us? So the challenge here is not particularly the really obvious moral questions that I think, you know, we would maybe think of first. How can we live differently that might reflect Jesus to the people around us? But perhaps also include some that are maybe in the gray areas for us, right? Like, how much time are we spending on social media? How do we manage work-life balance? Do we look any different than everyone else who's perhaps living a certain way? How well are we resisting the lure of packing our lives with busyness? That's always been a challenge for me, for sure. And are we carving out time to be alone with the Lord? That just takes such a push against our culture, I feel like, is to say, I'm going to put the phone down. I'm going to stop. I'm going to listen to the Lord. I'm just going to be in the quiet. We're working on this in our groups in our church, and it doesn't come easily, that's for sure, to push back. And have we left ourselves a bit of margin that we can have patience and compassion with those around us? Because I know there's times when you think you've just got to get through your list, and it's, you know, is there a way we can slow down and make time for opportunities to be compassionate and to show God's love to those around us? So does that work to just consider that, or?
That's a whole lot.
It's a lot. Well, just how, like, pick one of those. Like, what are the ways that you think we as followers of Jesus can push back against the culture around us to better reflect who Jesus is? Does that simplify it a little bit? It could be the way you spend your time. It could be the social media. It could be. So, all right?
Thank you for listening to the Groundswell podcast. For more info or to support Groundswell, check out www.thegroundswellchurch.com. Grace and peace.